Barack Obama in southern Indiana. Why the visit? The president makes use of the Gary Airport. Will others follow suit? The governor's new approach to prison, gay marriage on hold at the Supreme Court, and the Indy 500 blackout called into question. That plus a book burning of sorts and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending October 3, 2014.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T. Rethink possible.
This week, President Barack Obama came to Indiana for the first time since 2011. He visited Millennium Steel, a minority-owned steel plant in Gibson County, on Manufacturing Day. Here's how the president began his remarks.
Factories like this one, all over the country, are opening their doors to give young people a chance to understand what opportunities exist in manufacturing in the 21st century in the United States of America. So I figured what better place to celebrate Manufacturing Day than with a manufacturer.
What prompted this presidential visit? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Tim Berry, John Schwanes, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV Statehouse reporter Jim Schellick. Tim Berry, is the president here for political reasons?
Well, I think he was here recognizing that Indiana is one of the leading manufacturing states in the country. And for political reasons, you know, if it was for political reasons, he might have gone to some other states. But, you know, there are some states where there are some targeted races that maybe he's not as welcome in right now.
Well, I mean, there are no contested races in Indiana. Clearly, he didn't campaign for any Indiana candidates while he's here. But this is a message that he can use in other states.
Right? Well, it's a message he can use across the country. I mean, what was it?
Unemployment numbers are out today.
Down the lowest since 2008. 248,000 jobs created. I mean, you know, did it recover? Did the economy recover from the Bush recession as fast as we wanted? No. Were there obstacles put in place by Congress along the way? Yes. But look at where we are now. I mean, we are a manufacturing state. Energy prices are down. Our dependence on foreign oil is way down. And the results of that mean that this is a favorable manufacturing climate for people. And you contrast that with Europe, they're on the verge of deflation and have high unemployment. So it's a success story, and it's something to celebrate across the country.
But it would have been good if he maybe would have visited one of our southern Indiana coal manufacturers.
Well, Congressman Larry Bucyan.
You manufacture coal? You make it?
Well, no.
You mine it.
Manufacturing is dependent upon a lot of Indiana coal across this state.
It's dependent on a lot of different things, including natural gas and including oil.
Congressman Larry Bucyan greeted the president and offered him an invitation to visit a coal mine with him. That was clearly his political move for the day.
There's no doubt about that.
Well, when the president's here, let's make him aware of what is important to our community
I think what's important to our community are good-paying jobs, you don't come up to the president and say you have a couple of extra spare hours you want to go take for anything other than political reasons.
The president did have 5 extra minutes to talk with Governor Pence, who also greeted him. And according to the governor, they had a candid and substantive conversation about HIP 2.0. Apparently, things aren't going well on that front in the negotiations with the federal government.
Well, I think the longer they go, the less likely it is that the state will get what it wants. And, you know, there is an incentive for both sides to reach an agreement so that the state can say we can expand Medicaid under these circumstances and not call it an expansion. And the federal government wants to be able to do this because it wants to improve the number of people who are uninsured for the success of the overall plan. So there is an incentive in place for both, but the federal government apparently is less reticent, is reticent to do what the governor had said weeks ago he thought they were on the verge of doing, and that is approving the plan. So, you know, he took care of an opportunity, and we'll see if it pays off, but he needs it to happen.
5 minutes face-to-face with the president, can that make a difference?
And maybe at the margins, but you look at the discussions and negotiations that have been taking place at multiple levels. I mean, certainly we've heard a lot about, you know, when all the way back to when Kathleen Sebelius was still in that office before her departure.
Secretary.
Yeah, with the negotiations. So, but I have to assume that that's the tip of the iceberg, and that there is a lot of staff work and a lot of exchange of data and information and real critical policy discussion going on as well. But I mean, to your initial question about was this political? The simple answer, I think, is yes, and all you have to do is look at a calendar, and we're 30 days out from the midterm
right.
elections. So I would suggest to you that anything that the president does between
now... Well, I thought you meant the governor.
No.
Well,
that's
both.
What I thought you meant.
Maybe both. Maybe both. But yeah, the president coming to Evansville, it is worth noting that Evansville TV gets into Illinois where there's a governor's race, and it gets into Kentucky where
there's a
senator's race.
All of those, obviously, are important. But I think here there are problems. The copay, I think, is a sticking point. Other states have done this. Arkansas has done it for several years under their own plan. Kentucky has. You know, Governor Pence has got to realize that it's important that 300,000 people get health care coverage, and he better start negotiating.
Well, Governor Pence has said if they don't go along with the copays that he'd have to reconsider. Is it a deal breaker?
Well, I don't know if it's a deal breaker or not, because I'm not a part of the detail of the conversation negotiation that's going on. But certainly it is an important aspect of that. But you notice that while it may reach into Kentucky TV, he didn't go across the river to go see Allison Grimes.
And he didn't go to Tennessee, and he didn't go to Missouri, and he didn't go to Texas.
Earlier in the week, the president made a visit to Chicago, but Air Force One landed at the Gary Airport, in part due to ongoing air traffic control problems in Chicago. Nevertheless, Gary Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson hopes it serves as an example to others who are traveling to Chicago.
Businesses see how easy it is for the president to get in and to go to Chicago and do the things that he needs to do, then it sends a message to them that they can do likewise.
And, Delaney, will this make a difference for Gary?
Well, I would hope so. I mean, we Air Force One can land there. It just shows that any jet can
actually
land there.
Actually, had to take a smaller plane than they
normally
do.
Well, maybe, but we can still expand that. There's room. We've been working on this since the Biden administration, and it's time. Illinois can't get its act together for a third airport. It's clearly needed, and that's a perfect location. And with a rail connection, it would be great.
It can't hurt Gary, certainly.
It certainly can't hurt. And I give Mayor Freeman Wilson credit for trying to make as much out of the president landing in Gary as possible to encourage businesses to use Gary as a reliever airport to conduct business in Chicago. I just wish the president would have taken a motorcade to Chicago like other businesses would use instead of the helicopter.
Instead of
then
Marine
he probably
One.
Would still be sitting there in traffic. Gone from Chicago.
Well, but that defeats the whole purpose of why
well,
the importance of the Gary Airport.
That's why you have rail. That's why rail is so important.
Well, is this a plus or a minus for Gary?
Oh, it's a plus. Anytime you've got the president and his entourage coming through, and the mayor did make some comment about coming and visiting and staying longer next time, which the president, you know, responded that I guess he would like to do that. So anytime you're on the map in that context, sure. I mean, I'm not sure I would say there's a bad component, as Ann suggested. I remember this push back in the late 80s, early 90s to make Gary the third Chicago airport. Little do we know it would just take 20-some years to get that accomplished.
Ways to go, but we're making progress. I mean,
but part of the lesson here is that push has faded, and it's not getting the attention that it has.
Well, the whole third airport notion has not really commanded the interest that it commanded at the time. I can remember a site called Piatone. I'd never heard of Piatone, Illinois, until that whole thing was going on. But, you know, we saw what the trouble that they had up there and how interconnected all of these systems are, that you need to have options. And so maybe this will be the spur that says there needs to be a reliever airport, there needs to be a bigger system of reliever airports, and it would be a big deal for Gary to have that kind of traffic coming out.
It would be huge. And if you got rail transportation into Chicago, it would be a phenomenal addition.
Well, it would essentially just require a spur up to the North Shore, and then you go.
There you go.
The South Shore.
I'm sorry, South Shore. I guess North Shore would be in Wisconsin.
Yeah, we don't want that.
A state prison in Plainfield is being turned into a facility for first-time offenders in a program unlike any other in the country. The governor was on hand this week to announce the unveiling of the new program. It will include character and faith-based programs with addiction services and other programs aimed at reforming prisoners and preventing a return to prison once they're released.
If you're interested in that. It's based on fundamental principles, keeping low to moderate risk offenders separated from high risk offenders. You know, I got to tell you, it is just common sense to say that when an individual makes a poor choice and they are sent to a state facility, we don't want that to be a place where they can learn more about the wrong choices in life.
John Ketzenberger, will that work?
I certainly hope so, because warehousing people for crimes that are nonviolent and, you know, indiscretions that can be corrected is not the best way to go about this. I think the governor makes a very good point at the end of his comments there. And I think that, you know, in the context of his Christian faith, it's the right thing to do, to try to get people to believe that people can be rehabilitated and contribute to society in a positive way. The thing that they're going to have to watch is the civil liberty threat, and that is, you know, if you make this an overtly Christian or overtly religious type of a program, then you are on dangerous ground legally.
It's for people who are deemed a low to medium risk and serving 3 years or less, and the idea is they're kept out of the general prison population.
Right. I guess it's true that the best training ground for criminals who want to become, you know, irretrievable hardened criminals is to be in the general prison population, where, you know, gang membership is perhaps the only tool, means of survival, and you come out in many cases worse than when you went in. With having these first-time offenders, people who are largely not a risk, you know, low as you to moderate risk, as you said, Jim, and if, in fact, you can give them the services that are going to get them to, you know, walk the straight and narrow, to employ cliche, it's going to pay dividends. You've got a 36% recidivism rate in the population now. If you cut that...
Within 3 years.
Yeah, within 3 years. So if you cut that
20,000 prisoners
you're
go,
be,
into the,
it's significant
go out
numbers.
Of prison every year, and almost 36% within 3 years are back. This is a prison that's operated by a private company under a state contract, and much of the work that's going to be done in these programs will be done by volunteers. Is there any reason to worry about a lack of state control here?
Well, there certainly is oversight of the program, and has been. I mean, they've been involved in managing the prisons in the state of Indiana for a while.
The GEO Corporation.
Right. So this is nothing new from that perspective. What is really new is focusing on trying to reduce the recidivism rate that John talked about. Over a third of the population returns within 3 years. And what we're doing certainly isn't working, and trying something different is certainly worth the effort.
And they talk about addiction services and faith-based programs, but job training may be the most important
thing. Well, that's what I was going to point out. I mean, the recidivism is in part. I have no objection to segregation for the less violent offenders. I think that's a good idea because you do learn a lot more than you need to know when you're in a maximum security prison. But the biggest problem with recidivism is jobs when you get out, and we need a program that does that. That's why I want to see the money put in the community corrections program that is ongoing and not properly funded. Because, you know, if the answer was only to pray your way out of prison, the jails would be empty. You know, we've got to have
The recidivism rate for those who don't have a job is 60%.
Well, that's the point. Yeah. And so you really need to have job training and a way to put them into positions where they can earn a living wage.
You talk about the role of the volunteer. One twist, as I understand this program, that I'm eager to see how it turns out, once people have moved through this program, graduated, for lack of a better way to put it, they are going to be able to come back and serve as mentors and role models.
Right.
And which, if the common criticism is, how can you relate to what I'm going through? You're the other side of the equation. You've never been in behind bars. There goes that excuse, because these are the individuals who will have been there, done it, and have turned their lives around. And if they can have the moral authority to move others in that direction, it'll be pretty positive, I would think.
First program of its kind in the country. Why hasn't this been thought of before?
Well, I don't think there's anything unique. These techniques are not outrageously unusual, but employing them in this particular fashion makes sense. I mean, that's the mark of an idea that's worth trying, is it just at its base makes sense, and it does make you wonder why it hasn't been done before.
The U.S. Supreme Court this week began disclosing which cases it will hear in the current term and which ones it won't. So far, there is no word on the case involving the legality of gay marriage in Indiana. We should learn next week whether the High Court will hear the Indiana case or a similar case from another state. John Schwanes, does this delay mean anything?
I don't think so, really. I mean, this was the first day that the court could have taken this case up. They have, as you pointed out, I think October 10th would be the next opportunity when they will convene to consider what cases they will accept. I don't see any way conceivable, well, I guess there's always a conceivable way, that they could dodge this issue because of how much litigation has unfolded across the country.
Well, there's some talk of waiting for pending cases in other appeals courts.
Well, and part of the reason is there isn't a
There's no split.
Right. You have most, all but one of the cases have gone, the one direction in terms of making them legal. We only have the one decision that says that it upheld the statute in, I believe, Texas. And so, until you have some...
Louisiana, yeah. And that's only a district court. That's not the Court of Appeals.
Right. So you don't have really a dissension yet. You don't have a point of argument because all of the decisions have gone one way.
But you do have a lot of stays where a lot of people are in limbo, and I
think...
Yeah,
that's
but they
true,
can end
but,
the limbo by denying
well,
cert.
Right, right.
They deny cert. Gay marriage is legal
right.
in Indiana now.
Well, and that's maybe the better question
and
is,
that may
do
be
they do
the
that
option
or do they
take?
Do
well,
the, yeah, right.
Is that what supporters of gay marriage would rather see?
Oh, I assume that they'd rather have the controversy ended and gay marriage recognized. And all the Supreme Court has to say is, at least now, there is no division in any of the courts of appeals, and so therefore there's no controversy that's ripe for us to look at. We're not going to touch it.
But
in which case, it is then legal here.
But even if it does go to the court, I think there's great confidence on the part of same-sex marriage advocates that it would at worst be 5-4, and I would guess probably
I
more.
I think it's going to come down that way also.
6-3.
But the point is that that's a year from now as opposed to next week.
Yeah.
Okay, what's better, a Supreme Court ruling or let the appeals court ruling stand?
Well, I think we'll hear from the Supreme Court in the coming weeks, and they'll make that determination for us, and we'll find out.
You're willing to stand by whatever they do?
Well, I think that's the law of the land, isn't it?
That's the way it works.
That's the way it works.
That doesn't keep people from complaining.
It never keeps people from complaining. I put a lot of laws down in my household. That doesn't mean my son doesn't complain.
Gotcha.
Or follow.
Well,
That's true.
What's the recidivism rate in your among the kids?
Probably more than 36%.
The FCC decided this week to end its role in television blackouts. The change affects the NFL. The league and its broadcast partners have long agreed to black out local broadcasts of games that do not sell out. But what about the Indianapolis 500? There is no law keeping the 500 off the air in Indianapolis. That blackout is the result of a contractual agreement between the Indy 500 and the network. But IMS President Doug Bowles issued a statement saying, upon initial review, it appears unlikely that this will have any direct effect on our past practice. And Delaney, is that practice outdated?
Well, I mean, it does raise the question, doesn't it? Because now you've got a deregulation on the part of the federal government, and now we know who's responsible. If there's a blackout, we know that it's the IMS's decision not to let everybody else see it. And that may not be popular now that we understand that it's not the big, bad FCC in getting in the middle of this.
Well, it's all about selling tickets so that people will come and see the race in person, and they don't sell as many tickets as they used to. Is their argument being diluted?
There are a lot of events that don't sell the number of tickets as they used to. I mean, look at the college football games and the stadiums that are half empty today because that used to be full. You know, I think it's worked well for the greatest spectacle in racing over the last number of years. And, you know, do we really want to mess with what's worked so well?
So you think the blackout should continue?
Well, I think that is something that needs to be looked at. But let's create the spectacle at the event.
If the NFL...
There's nothing better than it.
Yeah, but if the NFL loses its ability to have blackouts, does the argument become tougher to sell to the public?
Oh, I suppose, but I'm not sure I understand. I mean, let's give the public more credit, perhaps, than we are. I mean, this is a contractual issue versus a regulatory issue. The regulatory handcuffs have come off. You know, the FCC and the federal government are effectively out of the game. If I sat here long enough, I could probably come up with a list of lots of events, whether they're concerts or sporting events or activities that are delayed by contract for any number of reasons. So I'm sure there'll be pressure. And now the NFL also suggests that this could, the threat at the end of this now is that once the current contracts expire, you might have more pay television. You know, and then if you want to see the public angry, it'll probably be when...
They've got a hotter commodity than the 500 does.
Well, and the problem is in a lot of these sporting events have priced themselves out of the market. You want to take a family of four to an NFL game or even to decent seats at the 500, it costs a fortune. And the problem with the analysis that this is all private is they are doing this in facilities with substantial state money.
And suddenly, that wasn't the case with the 500 until recently.
It is now, as it is with the Colts and the Pacers.
I think that we're really also talking, we haven't talked about the fact that we're on the verge of technology breakthrough that will allow people to have the same experience in their seats with their devices that they could have at home in terms of the quality of the broadcast and the ability to gather that information.
Right.
So you put the two together, that can create an incentive to come be there live and to experience the technology at the same time. You know, I think that this just opens the doors to innovation for anybody who's smart enough and savvy enough to go through them.
So what you're saying is there are a series of events here that are conspiring to make the blackout at the 500 unlikely in the future.
I think if the folks at the IMS do what they're capable of doing, and I think that they will, they'll be able to make the live experience the one that you want to have, and part of that will be the ability to experience the technology at the same time. From your seat.
You can't walk through the infield when you're sitting on your couch watching at home, right?
So that's true.
You can't get stuck in traffic either.
Well, okay. See, I'm a glass half full kind of guy. And you're
seeing all the crowd. That's part of the 500.
Well, I don't think people are going to stop coming, but you have to take into account the fact that if you have tens of millions of tax dollars in this isn't just a private enterprise thing anymore.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: should the Indy 500 blackout remain in place? Your choices are A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, should Eric Turner's name still be on the ballot? 27% said yes, it's the law. 73% said no, the law should be changed. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Finally, performance artist Tim Yaud spent days retyping the classic novel Fahrenheit 451, a task he finished this week. Yaud worked and slept at the Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library, and once he finished, he set the work on fire. The library invited Yaud to perform as part of Banned Books Week, which celebrates access to books in America.
Whether we're readers or non-readers, it's a civil right. It's something that's super important that we protect our ability to access literature in a free way.
Tim Berry, is that time well spent?
I don't think I'd be typing a book like that and putting it on fire.
On a single page. He typed it on a single page, so it was far from legible.
Yeah.
And then destroyed what he'd done.
You're not down with the monks at all, are you? You don't get this notion of Zen, do you, Jim?
Explain that to
Zen
me, please.
You know, yes, it can be Zen. I mean, it's the whole idea. It's the notion that you do this for the purpose of doing it and no other reason. And you, by the way, have the opportunity to say, these are important works. Well, you should pay attention.
I like
to
the
them.
Fact
Wouldn't
that the.
Wouldn't you think he'd type one of Vonnegut's works?
Well, maybe next time. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Tim Berry, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shello of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Programming is made possible by Ice Miller. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
AT&T, working to enhance connectivity in Indiana by investing in communication networks. Dedicated to helping Hoosier businesses grow and consumers succeed both at home and at work. AT&T, rethink possible.